bear envelope the heaven and possess the earth.
From the heights, a greater voice came down. The word that touches the heart and finds the soul. The voice of light after the voice of night. Oh, soul. Bear not thy kingdom to the soul, that all in thee may live except you. God must be born of earth and be a man. Let man be human, may God human as God. Cast off thy mind, step back from form and name. Annul thyself, that only God may be.
Good morning, everyone. We are reading in Book 7, and we've reached Canto 6. Nirvana and the discovery of the all-negating Absolute. This is the longest canto in this book. Last week we had a first look at it. We read to the end of the first section. And then we went back, and I think we just looked closely at the first page, 532. I think we just... Where did we stop?
1, 2, 3, 4, 5 lines down.
35. We should start today at line 35. Yes. Well, we'll just summarize it a bit. We finished reading this very important canto, The Finding of the Soul. We saw how Savitri came in contact with her own individual being and the central being, which is its source, the Supreme Divine Mother. And we saw how, as a result of that realization and Savitri's aspiration for total union with her higher being, that there was a transformation of all the psychic centers of the being, all the chakras. So that brought her into an extremely happy state. And we saw this happy state of hers reflected in the world around her. Jocelyn asked me to say something about this, because in poetry, when this happens, when a psychological state of one of the protagonists is projected onto the nature around, there's a technical term for this. The rationalistic critics have called this the pathetic fallacy. The pathetic fallacy. Pathetic as in sympathetic. As if there could be some kind of sympathy, some kind of resonance from a human consciousness to the world around. And they say that is a fallacy. It's something false, untrue. So they dismiss this as a figure that can be used in poetry. But here in this first page, Sri Aurobindo clearly showed us that he was not doing this just as a poetic device to make us feel the happiness of Savitri reflected in the nature around. He very clearly says that the mild ascetics, all the other aspirants who were living around the hermitage where she lives, they distinctly felt a sudden greatening of their lonely muse. They've all been doing their individual tapasya, sadhana, but in their individual isolated efforts, now, because of this realization of Savitri, they feel that they are uplifted. They have a new experience. So this bright perfection of Savitri's inner state poured, overflowing into her outward scene. And for her, perhaps also for the people around her, it made all the dull, common, natural things into something beautiful. And action, all the little daily acts became wonderful. Time, the passing of time, is something divine. Even the smallest, meanest work became a sweet, or glad and glorious sacrament, an offering to the self of the great world, or a service to the one in each and all. And I think these lines somehow typify the psychic state when the psychic being is fully to the front and active and dominant. This is how it feels. Even the smallest, meanest work becomes something sacred. It's either an offering to the self, the universal self of the great world, or a service to the one consciousness who contains and inhabits everything and each and every being. I think that's where we stopped. You would begin today, Patty?
Above the cherished head of Satyavan. Mm.
Okay, yes. Yes.
She saw not now fate's dark and lethal orb. A golden circle round a mystic sun disclosed to her newborn predicting sight the cyclic rondure of a sovereign life. In her visions and deep-etched veridical dreams, in brief shiftings of the future's heavy screen, he lay not by a dolorous decree, a victim in the dismal anter of death, or born to blissful regions far from her, forgetting the sweetness of earth's warm delight, forgetting the passionate oneness of love's clasp, absolved in the self-wrapped immortal's bliss. Always he was with her, a living soul that met her eyes with close, enamored eyes, a living body near to her body's joy.
Thank you.
But now
no, thank you. Thank you. In the first canto of this book, before Savitri took up the search for her soul, we were shown how she was suffering this great ordeal of the foreknowledge of Satyavan's death. She had to live every day with the knowledge that he's going to die. So that was like seeing, whenever she thought of him, saw him, a kind of dark circle or shadow. Fate's dark and lethal orb, something that's lethal, kills you. Instead, now she's seeing a wonderful golden circle around a mystic sun. So this reveals to her newborn predicting sight, as a result of this transformation that's come to all the centers, and particularly the site, the center of vision in this case. So she can see into the future, this newborn predicting sight. She can see that he is destined to have the cyclic rondure of a sovereign life. He's going to live a full lifespan as a master, as a ruler. That's his destiny. She has visions, she has dreams. He says deep-etched, veridical dreams. Dreams that speak the truth. And they are ones which make a very strong impression that can't be forgotten. Etching is when artists make a picture on a metal plate, an image on a metal plate, by burning into it with acid. So it makes a very permanent image. So that's etching. So these dreams are deeply etched into her consciousness. And sometimes there are brief shiftings of the future's heavy screen, as if this thing that prevents us from seeing the future gets moved for a moment, and she can see into the future. And she sees him not lying as a victim in the dismal anter of death in a dark cave. He's not there, no? And he's not in heaven. He's not carried to blissful regions far from her, where he would forget the sweetness of earth's warm delight and the passionate oneness of love's clasp, because he'd be dissolved, set free from all that in the bliss of the immortal. Instead, when she looks into the future, she sees him always with her, a living soul that met her eyes with close, enamored eyes, eyes that show his love for her. And he's a living body near to her body, which feels great joy to be close to his. So this is a very different state from that she was suffering before, of anxiety and grief and fear, tension. So it continues with what she sees for his future, Jana.
But now, no longer in these great wild woods, in kinship with the days of bird and beast, and level to the barnacles of the earth's brown breast, but meet in the thinking hideout of men, in tapestried chamber and on crystal floors, in armored town or gardened pleasure walks, even in distant clothes than her thought, body to body near, soul near to soul, moving as if by a common breath and will. They were tied in the single circling of their days, together by love's unseen atmosphere, inseparable like the earth and sky. Thus, for a while, she tore to golden path. This was the sun before abysmal night.
Thank you. Is it clear? Anybody would like to ask anything?
But now, no longer in these great wild woods, what does that mean?
Means that when she looks into the future, she doesn't see them living in the forest, but they'll be among the lives of men, and a very elevated level, these high-built lives in palaces. So the setting is different, and she sees them experiencing an even deeper closeness. Now that previously she had the experience that when he was in the forest, she would feel herself close to him. But now it seems to be a mutual closeness. Even in distance, closer than her thoughts. And it's as if they're moving, both of them being moved by the same shared breath and the same shared will, tied together. So their days are following the same circle. They're united by this unseen atmosphere of love, so that they can't be separated. They're like earth and sky. They belong together. Yes, the golden path. Sri Aurobindo and Mother talk about the sunlit path. Now, when you can live by the light of the inner sun. So it's something like that. This very, very, very happy state that she's in. She can tread that path for a little while, but there's a new challenge coming that will help her to an even greater realization. So this was the sun before abysmal night. She's going to have to pass through a very deep, dark state. And that's what comes next. Amitoj, would you read?
Once, as she sat in deep, felicitous muse, still quivering from her lover's strong embrace, and made her joy a bridge twixt earth and heaven, an abyss yawned suddenly beneath her heart. A vast and nameless fear dragged at her nerves, as drags a wild beast its half-slaughtered prey. It seemed to have no den from which it sprang. It was not hers, but hid its unseen cause. Then rushing came its vast and fearful fount, a formless dread with shapeless, endless wings, filling the universe with its dangerous breath, a denser darkness than the night could bear, enveloped the heavens and possessed the earth. A rolling surge of silent death, it came, curving round the far edge of the quaking globe, effacing heaven with its enormous stride. It willed to expunge the choked and anguished air and end the fable of the joy of life.
Thank you. It's like an enormous black sandstorm enveloping the whole earth, and the earth is shaking with fear. This is not just a physical cloud or storm. This is a psychological state, a very, very powerful, dark state of dread, of fear, of apprehension, foreboding. You can't see the sky anymore. No? And it tries to choke the life out of you. It will to expunge, to abolish the air that we breathe. No? Well, there's a choking, anguished feeling. It's a surge of death. This can come.
We have more fear.
It's possible, yeah. Yes, because the psychic realization is still an individual realization. So, and of course this is a challenge. She's found her soul, she's feeling this great joy living in it. But there's another side to reality, to life. And she has to be faced with that in a very, very intense way. Because for her, the psychic realization is not the last realization. She has two more steps. Yes.
How do we have to understand that it was not hers?
Yes, when she first feels it, there's this sudden, as if a, you know, everything's fallen away, there's no support anymore, a deep, a dark hole beneath her heart, and this fear, terrible fear. And then she looks at it and she sees that this is not her individual fear. This is something else.
Even after the wonderful experience.
Yeah, that's what Mi Hong was just asking. So perhaps personally we can say that she would not normally feel fear, but instead she's faced by this universal state, this dark side of reality.
For her it comes from outside.
Yes. And it seems to envelop the whole world.
It makes me think, I don't know if it's related or not, but just from her personal experience, like after she met Sri Aurobindo, she had this, you know, wonderful meeting with him, and then quite soon the First World War broke out. And then she also had to go through this kind of difficult phase.
Yes, a very, very difficult time. Yes. And this is because the day bringer must walk in darkest night. No? Narad had warned that she will have to suffer a great deal in order to solve this problem of the darkness of things. And now she's encountering it. Before there was this foreboding that, oh, Satyavan is going to die. But this is something much huger and stronger and darker. Shall we go on, Lorraine, you would read?
Right. Can you tell me which one got so wrapped up in?
Yes, line 83. It seemed her very being.
Okay. It seemed her very being to forbid, abolishing all by which her nature lived, and labored to blot out her body and soul. A clutch of some half-seen invisible, an ocean of terror and of sovereign might, a person and a black infinity. It seemed to cry to her without thought or word. The message of its dark eternity and the awful meaning of its silences, out of some sullen, monstrous vast arisen, out of abysmal deep of grief and fear, imagined by some blind, regardless self. A consciousness of being without its joy, empty of thought, incapable of bliss, that felt life blank and nowhere found a soul. A voice to the dumb anguish of the heart conveyed a stark sense of unspoken words. In her own depths, she heard the unuttered thought that made unreal the world and all life meant.
Thank you. A consciousness of being without its joy. It's almost a kind of contradiction. If we think of pure existence, then we know that it has to be full of consciousness and bliss. But this is just the being, the existence. A consciousness of existence without its joy. Incapable of bliss. He has a name. Sri Aurobindo calls him Death. Yes. Yeah. This is her first encounter with her great adversary, Death. I mean, that's the name that Sri Aurobindo gives to him in the poem. It's the great negation, the eternal no that she has to encounter. Its Sanskrit name, we might say, is Asat. That means non-being. But here there's a consciousness of being, but without bliss. It's something very, very dark. And it, as you point out, it's both personalized and at the same time infinite, black infinity. It's a dark eternity. That's what she's experiencing. Terrible experience. Yeah. Perhaps people who get into a very, very deep state of depression, they experience something like this. And they have the feeling that there's no escape from it. So this person speaks, or at least she hears something that is an unuttered thought. It's a thought. It comes to her in the form of words. Ellen.
Who art thou who claimest thy crown of separate birth, the illusion of thy soul's reality, and personal godhead of an ignorant globe, in the animal body of imperfect man? Hope not to be happy in a world of pain, and dream not listening to the unspoken word, and dazzled by the inexpressible ray transcending the new superconscious realm. To give a body to the unknowable, or for a sanction to thy heart's delight, to burden with bliss the silent still supreme, profaning its bare and formless sanctity, O call into thy chambers the divine, and sit with God, tasting a human joy.
Thank you. So it's really mocking this wonderful realization that she's had. No? Do you think that's real? You think that you are real? This is a world of pain, and you're going to have to suffer. And don't think that you are going to be able to get the sanction of the divine to your happiness. That silent, still, supreme, that is something bare and formless. No? You're not going to... There are, of course, stories in the ancient literature about princesses being able to call a god into their chamber. No, he said, don't think anything like that is going to happen. You won't be able to sit with God, tasting a human joy, this love that you hope to experience with Satyavan. Yes, this is a different experience. He's working and experiencing on the life levels, the vital levels going. It's also a very great darkness there. And he's able to, by the strength of his spirit, to pass through that and move into a very great realization, the liberation of the life being, and to enter the life heavens. I think this is something different. Savitri is being confronted with her mission. This is what she is here for, to overcome this darkness, this silent surge of death. But she's meeting it for the first time, and it's very, very powerful. Overwhelming experience. Towards the end, where we are now on the Thursday class, we hear in detail all that this person has to say, this embodiment of death. But by then she's become able to withstand and to answer him. And now she's meeting this challenge for the first time.
Line here, I have created all I devour.
That's just what we're about to read, Don. That's the next bit. Let's read it and then we'll talk about it. Yes. Luba, will you read?
I have created all I devour. I live, and the dark table mother of life, I am Kali Black and naked in the world. I am Maya and the universe is my chief. I re-rest human happiness with my breath and slay the will to live, the joy to be, that all may pass back into nothingness and only by the eternal and absolute. For only the blind, eternal can be true. All else is a shadow and a flash in the mind's bright glass. Mind, holy mirror in which ignorance sees a splendid figure of its own false self, and dreams it sees a glorious solid world. Also, inventor of man's thoughts and hopes, thyself the inventor of the moment's dream, illusion's center, or a subtle apex point, at last know thyself from where existence seems.
Mm, thank you. He really wants to destroy her soul. By convincing her soul, not just her mind, that it is an illusion. Soul is the inventor of man's thoughts and hopes. But you, O soul, you yourself are just an invention of the passing of time. You're some kind of center point of illusion. Know that. Dissolve from this useless existence. Let go. Become nothing. And it claims to be the ultimate reality. That's when this experience comes. It's very, very powerful and convincing.
So irritating, this mixture in it, also the illusion center or subtle apex point, and then subtitle later her development, there's she just one point or one line, and how, or also the I would not be happy in a world of pain, which is used in normal life also, always is this mixture bit, and in a way we have also to work with it.
Yes, that's what's going to come next. Yeah. No, she has this devastating experience, this challenge. And then a greater light comes to her and tells her what her response to this must be. Shows her the way to go beyond this. Yes, Don.
Again, I come back to that sentence, I've created all and all I devour. I can't imagine death being a liar and saying that I am something that death is not. So isn't this God in disguise?
Eventually, in book 11, she sees the fourfold form of the Supreme, and she realizes that, yes, this is the one who was testing me. So, in a sense. But that shouldn't... that's too easy. No, this is a reality when it's experienced. No? It's part of the omnipresent reality. So it's better to delude, not to delude oneself, to face this darkness and, well, we will see. Certainly this darkness that wills to lay waste human happiness with my breath and slay the will to live and the joy to be, this is not the great positive divine, the supreme that we believe in. and that we have to believe in order to live. This is some negation, terrible negation of the truth.
I don't know, but isn't it like sort of a test that you just mentioned? Isn't it sort of a test which we have to learn to overcome and realize the truth, which we are?
Well, mentally we can say that. Mentally we can say that. But wait till you have the experience and see whether that helps.
Have the experience is what we're being told.
Yeah.
Work on it. Get the experience.
Yes, of course, if you can really know that all the time, then it can carry you through everything, no doubt. It's very difficult for human beings to know that all the time, to know it with your whole being. Shall we read on? Yes. Tommy, what do you read?
Shadow of the negating absolute. The intolerant darkness traveled surging past and added in her the formidable voice. It left behind her inner words laid waste. A barren silence weighed upon her heart. Her kingdom of delight there no more. Only her soul remained, this empty stage, awaiting the unknown eternal will. Then from the heights, a greater voice came down, the word that touches the heart and finds the soul, the voice of light after the voice of night. The cry of the abyss, the heaven's reply, a might of storm chased by the light of the sun.
Thank you. We can look at the title of this canto, no? The All-Negating Absolute. And what she's just experienced is a shadow of the negating absolute, that aspect of absolute reality which seems to say no to everything. So the effect is, it's just like a great storm has come. Her inner world is laid waste. And there's a silence, but it's a barren silence weighing on her heart. All that delight and confidence and happiness she had been feeling, it's gone. So her soul is like an empty stage. And it is waiting. What is the eternal will now? The unknown eternal will. I suppose we could say that this is a form of surrender. Just waiting. Waiting. What is the eternal will now? And what happens is this voice of light comes down. The word that touches the heart and finds the soul. So the power of that storm is chased away by the power of the light of the Divine Sun. And there's quite a long speech from that voice.
Stages and material.
In the theatre, yes, you know, something has to happen on this stage. So what's going to happen next? Everything's been washed away, swept away. Gael, would you read?
O soul, bear not thy kingdom to the floor. Consent to hide thy royalty in bliss, lest time and place find out its avenues. And thunderous knock upon thy gates. Hide whilst thou canst thy treasure of separate self behind the luminous rampart of thy death. Still of a vaster empire it grows part. but not for self alone, the self is one. Content abide, not with one conquered will. Adventure all to make the whole world thine, to break into greater kingdoms, turn thy course. Fear not to be nothing, that thou mayst be all. Ascend to the emptiness of the Supreme, that all in thee may reach its absolute.
Thank you. Would you like to take a book? We are reading on page 536. Got it? Yes. So we just started now reading at line 146, where the quotation marks are. And we read to line 159. O soul, bear not thy kingdom to the foe. Don't expose yourself to all your soul realization, to all the adverse forces that are there in the world. Hide it. Keep it secret and safe. Otherwise, time and fate will find out how to attack you. They'll come clamoring, beating on your gates, on the gates of your self. Hide as long as you can that treasure of separate self, of the soul realization. Keep it hidden against the walls, behind the walls made of light of your deeper being, until it is ready to become part of a greater empire. With the psychic realization alone, you can't do what you have come to do. So keep it quiet, keep it hidden until you've joined that greater empire, that greater rule of light. That's the first thing. And then the second thing, it points out to her that this realization is not meant just for the individual, not just for you alone. Don't be remain satisfied with this personal realization, with one conquered realm. Take the risk of opening up to the whole world. Become strong enough to break into greater kingdoms. And the way to do this is not to fear being nothing. Fear losing your personal identity. Don't be afraid of that. Yes, what did you want to say, Lauren?
Over the last few weeks, in the 70s, I was reading Albert Camus about the nothingness and existentialism, and the times before that in France, where they a lot of creativity, but this darkness, the suicide, he killed himself, and in America, James Dean. This bleakness that life has no purpose. And this was after the wars. And this hopelessness.
Yes.
And the bleakness.
Yes.
So when you're talking about how do you keep this life, how do you not
Lose it.
Lose it, yeah.
Keep it quiet. Don't have to share it with anybody.
Okay.
Of course, that's the first impulse. This wonderful discovery. But here she's specifically advised to hide it as long as possible. That's not just the first part, of course, okay. More will come.
Okay.
And the other thing is, this death was threatening her with being devoured, with losing a separate existence. So this voice of light is saying, don't be afraid to become nothing, because you will become part of everything like that. Assent, accept the emptiness, that aspect of the Supreme, so that everything in you, every part of your being, not just this little selection which is the personal, the surface person, that everything in you may reach its absolute.
This whole poem was written to answer this philosophy she's mentioning, no?
Yes.
The whole world didn't know about the soul. They were saying God was dead. Well, I used to hear that when I was growing up. That makes me laugh now.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Shall we go on, Josie? Line 158, ascent to the emptiness.
Accept to be small and human on the earth, interrupting thy newborn divinity, that man may find his other self in God. If for thy own sake only thou hast come, an immortal spirit into the mortal's world, to found thy luminous kingdom, in God's dark, in the unconscious realm, one shining star, one door in the ignorant opened upon light. Why hast thou any need to come at all? Thou hast come down into a struggling world to aid a blind and suffering mortal race, to open to light the eyes that could not see, to bring down bliss into the heart of grief, to make thy life a bridge twixt earth and heaven. If thou wouldst save the toiling universe, the vast universal suffering feel as thine, thou must bear the sorrow that thou claimest to heal. The day bringer must walk in darkest night. He who would save the world must share its pain. If he knows not grief, how shall he find grief's cure? If far he walks above mortality's head, how shall the mortal reach that too high path? If one of theirs they see scale heaven's peaks, men then can hope to learn that Titan climb. God must be born on earth and be as a man, that man being human may grow even as a god.
Thank you. Accept to be small and human on the earth, interrupting thy newborn divinity. Don't make a big thing or a big show of this psychic realization. Because there's a bigger task to do. Humanity, the whole of humanity, must be able to find their utter self in God. So you can contribute to that effort. In a way, that's what we are all here for. You are, Savitri, you are an immortal spirit. And if you've come only for your own sake, why did you need to come at all? You've come down for a purpose. To open to light the eyes that could not see. To bring down bliss into the heart of grief. And to make thy life a bridge twixt earth and heaven. So now you're going to have to accept, to bear this sorrow that you've come to heal. The day bringer, the one who ushers in the light, it's the morning star, must walk in darkest night. And if there's too much gulf between the realized being and ordinary humanity, how can the rest of humanity hope to reach that high path? If they see a human being achieving the peaks of heaven, then they can hope to learn that Titan climb. I remember how many times Sri Aurobindo scolded Nirod Baran, because Nirod Baran was saying, oh, it's all right for you, you're an avatar, no? And it's quite different for us. And Sri Aurobindo said, nonsense. I have started just an ordinary human being like you, and I've done it so that you can follow my path. And that has to happen again and again and again. God must be born on earth and be as a human being so that human beings can grow to the divine state. Somewhere else he says it's a mutual debt binds God and man. He owes us something. He's put us in this mess. Now he has to get us out. But it's also our responsibility to do the best we can and fulfill our divine possibilities.
Tell something that happened this week, which is something amazing, which illustrates this. On Friday, I was doing the house cleaning, and I was feeling kind of lazy and out of sorts and all that. So I went to dump it in the garbage can. It was full. So I thought, oh, I have to walk all the way down there. I walked around the corner, and when I was about to put it in the other bin, there was a brochure there. It says, life has a purpose. This booklet was from Criminal Society. I opened it. In the inside cover was the name Muriel Spanier.
Wow.
She's a famous American.
Wow.
1985, she had written with a heart, you know, and signed her name.
Wow.
And so that thing had come all the way around the world and
to land there.
For me to pick that up and say, ah, yes, life has a purpose. So you see, the divine has a sense of humor, and we have to be open to see these things in everyday life. And that was amazing.
And the fact that it had her name on it made
exactly.
It more personally relevant to you. Yeah.
So the small things of life really matter. You never know where your love is going to go.
Yes, it's a pity. Well, I mean, one say it was a pity that it landed up in the dustbin, but you rescued it.
Yeah, now I keep it right in front of my chair when I feel down, as in life has a purpose. You're not in the garbage dump, you're in the garbage. This whole world is on.
That's what we're here for, to clean the garbage, yes. So shall we stop there for today? I think there are only two passages. Three? Okay. We can hear Mother reading some passages from this canto.
Above the cherished thing of Satyava, she saw not now fate's dark and lethal. Oh, a golden circle around a mystic sun disclosed to her newborn predicting sight the cyclic grandeur of rain light. One. as she sat in deep felicitous moods, an abyss yawned suddenly beneath her heart. A formless dread with shapeless, endless wing, filling the universe with its dangerous breath, a denser darkness than the night could bear, enveloped the heavens and possessed the earth. From the heights, a greater voice came down. The word that touches the heart and finds the soul. The voice of light after the voice of night. Bear not thy kingdom to the foe. Let all in thee may reach its absolute. God must be born on earth and be as man, that man, being human, may grow even as God. Cast off thy mind, step back from form and name, annul thyself that only God may be.
Thanks to Shri Aurobindo.